出すればいや。나대양높아보겸자나대양높아보겸자나대양높아보겸자룩다야루카산지탐룩다야루카산지탐Lubdhaya dhukha sanchitam Nadeyang napabhava Nadeyang napabhogyam cha Lubdhaya dhukha sanchitam Bhunkte Tat api Tach Chanyo Bhunkte tadapitaschanyo Bhunkte tadapitaschanyo Madhu hevatavin Madhu Madhu hevatavin Madhu Madhu hevatavin MadhuBhunkte tadapi chatachanyo Madhu hevata vinmadhu Nadeyang nopabhogyam cha Lubdhaya dhukha sanchitam Bhunkte tadapi chatachanyoMadhu hevarta vinmadhu Nadeyang nopabhogyam cha Lubdhaya dhukha sanjitam Bhunkte tadapi taschanyo Madhu hevarta vinmadhuNa, not. Deyam, to be given in charity to others. Na, not. Upabhogyam, to be enjoyed personally. Cha, also. Lubdhai, by those who are greedy.Yat, that which. Dhukha, with great struggle and pain. Sanchitam, is accumulated. And actually this is what we see, you know, this point that's being made here is dukkha sanchitam, which is accumulated with great struggle and pain. We see here in this material world that people accumulate.Opulences and facilities for enjoyment, but it actually takes some great struggle, great pain. You know, even like, you know, around here that they buy these houses and they go to great endeavor to make these tiny little houses like mansions. You know, spend a huge sum of money. And for what? You know, you'll see like that they go all this endeavor, they build a house and then they sell it.Or you know, like maybe they build this house and they're in debt to the bank and to, you know, huge sums of money. Some of these people are just like completely in debt, and then the economy crashes, and they have to sell it, or they lose it, or they commit suicide because they can't make the repayments. So we see this is very typical of the scenario in this material world. Is people are making such endeavor to expand their material enjoyment.Yet unable to enjoy it. I remember, actually, it's interesting, in my own example, my mother and father had worked for many years, and then they both worked. My father was doing two jobs and my mother was doing one job, to save up money to get a house. And finally, down in Lara, they built their dream home. And then my father, he had to go to, he got a job down in Antarctica, and he thought this would make more money, so he went down there. And he developed an ulcer, and he died. So they worked for years and years and years. As long as I remember, they were working, you know, really hard to try and get this house together. Finally, they got their dream home, and he wasn't able to enjoy it because of the cruel laws of material nature. See, Prabhupada often talks about the stringent law of material nature, and it doesn't discriminate whether it's you know, just like fire. It doesn't discriminate whether it's an old person, a sinful person, a pious person, a child. It doesn't matter. Fire burns. And so if it's your karma to suffer in a particular way, it doesn't matter you're a nice person, bad person, this, that, whatever. It doesn't matter. You'll get it. You'll suffer. You know, I mean, you hear children being maimed, disfigured, killed in horrible car accidents or so many different things. War, you know, I mean, you know, children are often, you know, the victims of war. Often the first victims of war. You know, like you hear often, just like, you know, it wasn't so long ago that there was that war in the Gaza Strip and that the people would be, they're just indiscriminately bombing. And, you know, I think the biggest casualties were civilians, women and children, indiscriminate. But this is, you know, from the Vaishnava perspective or from the perspective of the Vedic philosophy, we understand that this is actually the laws of karma. This is the laws of material nature. And they're not sort of considering, well, oh, okay, we won't like give this person their karma because they're only 4 or 5 years old, but we'll leave it till they get later. It doesn't work like that. If one is due to suffer, then one gets the reaction. There's nothing you can do about that. So we see that even though people make great endeavor, and just like we were talking the other day, Prabhupada, he uses the Vargas, and he talks about this fena, you know, foaming in the mouth. We see how people are sometimes working so hard, they're actually foaming at the mouth, you know, from this hard work to achieve their desired goals. And then what happens? Ma, mrityu, death. You know, they work so hard, yet they can't enjoy it. And that's the nature of the material world. Bhunkte, he enjoys. Tat, that. Api, nevertheless. Tat, that. Cha, also. Anya, someone else. Maduha, the one who steals the honey from the beehive. Actually, it's interesting. I know a devotee called Maduha in America. He's the devotee who, for many, many years, has been running the Festival of India in America. So he has these large trucks, and he travels around America from one city to another during the summertime. So probably starting about now in America, and they just put on roughly afterwards all around America. And he's worked very, very hard. It's been interesting. Maduha, the one who steals the honey from the beehive. It's the name of Krishna. Eva, like. Artha, wealth. Vit, one who knows how to recognize. This is one word, artha vit, one who knows how to see wealth. And there's actually, you may know the story of when, I think it was Narottam Srinivas, Narottam Das Thakur, Srinivas Acharya, and Sukhi Krishna, Shamananda, was it? Were traveling from Vrindavan to West Bengal, and they had many, many scriptures with them in a covered wagon. And when they came into a particular kingdom in Bihar, there was a dacoit king there, and he had an astrologer who had this ability to be able to see who had wealth and who didn't have wealth. And he told the king that these people are carrying the greatest wealth with them. He wasn't able to discriminate that it was books or anything like that. But so then the king's soldiers, they actually robbed them and stole these books. So quite an interesting story about that. But there are people who can actually identify the symptoms of wealth. They can see a person has wealth just by various, sometimes with astrological means, or other times just by seeing the symptoms of a person. Just like we see in Vedic culture, there's this art of physiognomy, whereby looking at a person's features, you know, the shape of their ears, the shape of their eyes, their nose, mouth, things like that, shape of their body, lips are also very interesting. The colour, it's said that, you know, a lusty person is red in different places, and one of the places they're red in is their lips. Also the nipples are often red when a person's very lusty. So these are different features of physiognomy, but a person who knows the art of physiognomy, just like Arjuna, he knew the art of physiognomy, he was able to tell a person's nature by looking at them. This is one of the Vedic arts. So someone who's skilled, especially Brahmanas used to know this art, and they would be able to tell the vana of a person just by looking at them. Be able to determine whether one's a Brahmana, a Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra just by looking at them. Unfortunately, this art is not very well known in this day and age, and we see things just like, you know, we were talking about this war in Gaza. So it's quite a common thing these days that they have conscription, that everyone has to go off to war. You know, that like young men from, I think it's from 18 to 25 or something like that. They used to have it in Australia. They stopped it. I remember all the different moratoriums and stuff. So after the moratoriums, they stopped it. But it used to be that you know, all the young men from a certain age, you know, I think it was from 18 to 25, had to go to war. You know, they had what they used to call it. They used to call it the lottery. You know, it's just your number was basically picked. Your name was just picked out of a barrel, and then if your number was up, you had to go. And because they were picking people who were unqualified to go to war, what happened is that it caused them great mental disturbance, actually to the point where many of them went crazy. You know, they came back from war and they couldn't sleep at night, and they'd all, you know, like, I even had an experience myself, you know, when we were in Sarajevo with Indra Dumraj, our Harinam party was attacked, and I was actually struck on the head with a gun. First they tried to shoot me, the gun didn't go off, so they hit me on the head with it. And I remember when we were back in Poland after that experience, that every time I saw someone sort of like, you know, like we were staying at a hotel there, and this car pulled up, and this guy pulled something out of the back of the car, I thought it was a gun. You know, just every time I saw something like that, I became fearful that someone was going to attack me again. So because, you know, they're not qualified for the position, then, you know, like they're not qualified to act as soldiers, they don't have the right nature, they get put into that situation, and it's very, very disturbing for them. Yet we see there are others, like you see in India, that there's a class of people there who like being soldiers, like the Gurkhas, they really like being soldiers, and they're expert soldiers. You know, and Sikhs, they're also, you know, they like being soldiers, they're very martial in their nature. So, you know, they function quite well in that situation, whereas others who don't get in that situation, they become very fearful. And often they do, instead of acting properly, like we see, you know, in this war in Iraq recently, that people were doing abominable things. They were torturing prisoners, they, you know, forcing them to do all sorts of, you know, subhuman sorts of things, because they're not actually qualified. Because the nature of a Kshatriya is he's chivalrous. He has nobility. He wouldn't do these things. He would never. You don't hear of Arjuna, you know, persecuting the enemy or torturing the enemy, or when he captures them, he, you know, puts thumb screws on them or makes them undress and stand for the camera and do all sorts of, you know, unpleasant things, because he's a Kshatriya. He has nobility. But when unqualified people are put into this situation, then they do things that are, you know, suited to their nature. They're sudras, therefore they don't know how to act in such a circumstance. So we see there that this art of it, you know, being able to understand a person's wealth just by seeing as part of this almost like the physiognomy, where a person can see, oh, this person's qualified to do this, therefore you know, we have this person as Kshatriya, this person as Brahmana. But in this day and age, no one's able to do that. Therefore, we see so many people in situations that they shouldn't be in, and it actually causes great disturbance in society. So, you know, from this we can see how the Vedic system was actually quite perfect. It was able to identify people according to their natures and engage them in such a way that ultimately led to their spiritual rectification. Whereas the system that's employed these days leads to a person's entanglement in the material energy, because the whole system is geared for sense gratification, which will be discussed a little bit here. And the last word is madhu, means the honey. Translation. A greedy person accumulates a large quantity of money with great struggle and pain. But the person who has struggled so much to acquire this wealth is not always allowed to enjoy it himself or give it in charity to others. The greedy man is like the bee who struggles to produce a large quantity of honey, which is then stolen by a man who will enjoy it personally or sell it to others. No matter how carefully one hides his hard-earned wealth or tries to protect it, there are those who are expert in detecting the whereabouts of valuable things, and they will steal it. It's exactly just like the government, is it? They're so expert at stealing money from people. They call it taxation. But what are they giving us in return for the taxation? Very little. Very little indeed. And actually, in the Vedic system, there's a flat tax. The Vaishyas got taxed 25% of their income. Flat tax. No fringe benefits, no nothing like that. Just flat tax for everyone. The Brahmins weren't taxed. Sudras weren't taxed. And the Kshatriyas weren't taxed. It's just those who made money. And then the government would keep that money. You know, they would spend for various things, but they'd also stockpile money. And then in times of difficulty, they would then release that money so that those who needed it could actually, they wouldn't sort of be struggling or suffering. And they'd also stockpile grains and things like that. So in times of drought and famine, there was a stockpile of grains that they would be able to feed people. And we're seeing that, you know, as Kali Yuga is progressing, that you know, grains, etc., are going to become more and more difficult to get. Grains, sugar, milk, things like this. And it's kind of interesting because I've been listening to quite a few lectures of Prabhupada from the first canto lately, where he's talking about how these, you know, basic necessities of life are going to become very, very difficult to acquire. And one reflection I had is it seems to me the way this is going to come about is because there's so many people now that are lactose intolerant. There's so many people these days who have problems eating wheat and stuff like that. So as the demonic sort of nature increases, then people are going to not be using these things. So the companies, because their whole motivation is economic, won't produce these things. And also the other facet of it is because the people are becoming more and more sinful, then the earth, just like we see in the story of Prithu Maharaj, the earth actually restricts its bounty because people are impious, therefore it doesn't produce the pious things, it produces impious things like weeds, crows, all this stuff. These are impious living entities. You know, weeds are impious, plants with thorns on them are impious, but plants with sweet smelling flowers are pious, plants with nice fruits are pious. But you'll see these things become more and more difficult to get. And you'll see with the fruits, the seeds will become bigger and bigger, yet the flesh of the fruit will become smaller and smaller. Just like in Ilabrika Vash, it describes how there's a mango tree on top of one of the mountains there, and this mango tree is gigantic. I think something like 800 miles high or something like that. And there's mangoes on this tree that are big as elephants, and the seeds are tiny. And when they drop on the ground, they just turn into juice, and the juice actually becomes a river. Yeah? And the river, you know, in this river, the demigods, they bathe in this river, and their bodies give off a beautiful aroma. And actually, from the river of mango juice, it's sort of the waves, they lap on the bank of the shore of the river, and produce gold. Very, very auspicious circumstance. But you don't see things like that in this age, you know. You go down to the bank of any river and usually it stinks so much from all the pollution and things floating in it. Very progressively becoming more and more impious. And we see here this description in this verse. It talks about how a greedy person accumulates a large quantity of money with great struggle, and they try to hoard this money and save it for goodness knows what reason. You know, I mean, some people have got like millions and billions of dollars stashed away in bank accounts, you know, secret Swiss bank accounts and all this type of stuff. But what for? What are they going to do with this money? I mean, some people have got more money than they could possibly spend in one lifetime. You know, I mean, there's some people in this world who literally have billions upon billions of dollars. What are they planning to do? No, they just have it there for the satisfaction of thinking, oh, I've got so much money.
For three generations, their son, their grandson, did against it.
Well, maybe that's the reason they're accumulating. But actually, you know, the thing is, they're working so hard, yet they can't enjoy. They're putting in so much labor, but they cannot enjoy the fruits of their labor. And sometimes we hear Prabhupada gives the example of various kings and things like that. They would cook these great big feasts, or rich people, they cook these big feasts, but because they had some digestive problem, they couldn't eat the feast themselves. They could only look at it. You know? So it's a little bit like that, you know, they have so much money, yeah, and sometimes you see like these older persons, they, you know, because they're wealthy, they like to keep, you know, employ young girls to, you know, almost like concubines, but because their body's so old and decrepit, they have the desire there, but they can't actually do anything. You know, they can just look and get their minds disturbed by that, but they actually can't control their, they can't control their senses, yet their body is so decrepit that actually they can't respond to it at all. And you know, we see this is quite common, that, you know, people do accumulate money, and then what happens is because they have this money and they're not so strong or they're not so intelligent, then they lose it. Just like this example of the honeybee and the honey collector, the hunter. And it's interesting because there's two examples here that the Avadhut Brahman is presenting to Yadu Maharaj from this story of the honeybee. And it's very interesting. One is how, you know, the hunter or the honeybee collector, the honey collector, he goes and he steals. Yeah? So he steals the honey from the bees because he's more intelligent and the bees are weaker. You know, they make smoke and they just generate the smoke and it makes the bees leave the hive and they all become sort of a little bit sort of, you know, dazed, so that they sort of lose their direction there, and then they steal the honey. Of course, what I've seen in India these days is they're not so charitably disposed to the bees. They don't make smoke anymore, they just make fire and burn them all. I saw that when I was there. We had a beehive outside the house we stay in Mayapur, so we got the bee man to come and we tried to get the bee man, actually, we couldn't get him, so we got some of the locals to do it. And they just made a big fire on a stick and burnt all the bees, killed them all. Mm-hmm. So they're not as merciful as they used to be. But generally, you see with a beekeeper, they'll make smoke, and the bees will all leave the hive, and they become sort of dazed, they don't come back, and they just take all the honey. So they're stealing. And another aspect of it is that... how mendicants, because he's talking here how a mendicant should be. How a mendicant is actually meant to not work hard to achieve the objects of enjoyment. So just like the honey collector, you know, someone else is working very hard to make the honey. And then the honey collector will just go and take it and enjoy it. So sadhu, I mean, everyone's meant to enjoy. We have senses. We're sentient beings. The senses are meant to be engaged in one way or another in the objects of the senses, but not that we indulge in the objects of the senses. We try to gratify our senses. We just, you know, satisfy the senses, as Prabhupada would often say, is we do whatever is necessary to keep body and soul together so that we can serve Krishna. So the senses do need to be satisfied. Otherwise, if the senses are not satisfied, they become agitated. Just like we have a tongue. The tongue has different businesses. The tongue is meant for vibrating. The tongue is also meant for tasting palatable dishes. So we see that most people, everyone's in, you know, vibrating their tongue. Just like, where was I walking the other day? I think in Ackland Street. And in Ackland Street, there's some palm trees there. And it was just around dusk, you know, and all the birds, they go into the tree and you hear them. They're all twitter, 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 you know, making so much noise at night, you know. And they're telling each other about their daily activities and this thing and that thing. You know, they're just talking. Nonsense. Gramyakata. And this kind of talk is actually, it entangles them in the bodily concept. They become more and more bound up. So, you know, there's also a verse in the first canto, in the second chapter, which talks about this. How worldly people are caught up in discussing topics which are like, what does it say? I can't remember the exact wording, a place of pilgrimage unto crows. And so they're attracted to these like crow-like topics. They're talking about what are crows like? They like to eat abominable things. You see them in Calcutta especially, because all the rubbish dumps are like on the side of the roads, underneath the bridges and things like that. And you always, early in the morning, you'll see the rubbish dumps are covered with hundreds and thousands of crows, and they're eating all sorts of unpalatable, decayed things on the rubbish dumps. So that's the sort of things crows like. Whereas the swans, you'll never see a swan in such a place. A swan's more attracted to places where, you know, swans like milk and honey and things like that. They like to eat palatable foodstuffs. So a swan-like man is attracted, you know, the Sanskrit word for a swan is hangsa. So a hangsa, or a paramahansa, which is a great mendicant, is attracted to the topics of the personality of Godhead, whereas the crow-like person is attracted to the topics of material nature, how to enjoy the senses, how to increase my material position. So, you know, they're accumulating wealth, they're accumulating various facilities for enjoyment, you know, just to satisfy the senses, whereas, and they make so much endeavor for this, whereas a sadhu doesn't make the endeavor. They just accept whatever comes of its own accord, and which can naturally be engaged in Krishna service. So you see that there's quite a difference between the two. You know, like a materialistic person is going to get whatever they can, go to great endeavor to get as much facility as they can to enjoy their senses, simply for the sake of their senses and their extended sense gratification, meaning family, country, friends, etc. They'll do whatever they can, but primarily focused on the self. How can I enjoy my senses? And we see that, you know, a materialistic person, they will even sacrifice their friends, their family, their country, if it jeopardizes their sense gratification. They always put themselves first, ultimately. Yeah? Whereas a devotee has a different angle. A devotee's business, or, you know, a saintly person's business, is simply to satisfy the senses of Krishna. As we see, this is described in the by Narad Muni, I believe. Was it Savo Padi Vinir Muktan Tatparatvena Nimalam Hrishikesha Hrishikena Sevaram Bhakti Ruchite? He talks about how a person who's a devotee understands who the proprietor of the senses is. He understands that these are Krishna's senses. This is Krishna's body. I belong to Krishna. I belong to the Lord. Hrishikesha. Isha means Lord. Hrishika means senses. So he understands that Krishna is the Lord of the senses. Krishna is the Lord of my body. Krishna is the Lord of me. So therefore he uses whatever facilities he has simply for the pleasure of Krishna. And in this way he becomes liberated from material bondage. Sava upadi. So upadi means these false designations, thinking that I am man, I am woman, I am this, I am that, I am doctor, I am dentist, whatever. You know, these are all upadis, because actually we are nothing to do with this body. Our only identification is, as pointed out in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, is Jivera Sarupahai Krishna Nityas. This is our factual identity. We are servants of Krishna. But in this world, people deluded by the bodily concept of life think that I am this body, I am the controller, I am the enjoyer. You know, from this ahankara, this false identification of the self, they're thinking so many erroneous things. But actually we see that the point being made there by Narad Muni is these are all upadis, these are all false designations. But by engaging in the service of Krishna, one becomes freed from these falsities. The Vinayamuktam. Vinayamuktam means mukta, means to be liberated. Yeah? So he becomes liberated from these false identifications and becomes restored to his pure identity by understanding, yes, I have a body. I'm not this body, I'm a soul. I'm this soul inside the body. I'm the living entity. This body is the property of Krishna. Therefore, what's that? Isha vasham idam sarvam yat kinchit jagatam jagat tena taktena bunjita margidha kashasvidyanam. He understands who's the proprietor. Understands that Krishna is the proprietor. He's given me this facility to use in his service. See, this is what the materialists are missing. The whole equation is wrong. They're thinking they're the body. This is the first problem. Therefore, they're thinking the body, therefore I have to satisfy the body. And they work very hard to please the body and the senses. And they get entangled in this misconception. Whereas, all they need to understand is that I'm not this body, servant of Krishna. The body is the property of Krishna. And from that, they could actually, develop a much better situation. But the situation they're in just causes further and further bondage. So for devotees, again, these different examples, these different 24 different gurus that are given here, are giving us a wonderful understanding of our situation in this material world, and also how we need to act in order to liberate ourselves. So the example of the honeybee, don't go to great endeavor to increase your material opulence, to increase your enjoyment, when it may so easily be stolen by someone else. And you think, you can make such endeavor for protecting your wealth, such endeavor for protecting your opulent position, your position of enjoyment, but we see how easily that is taken away by the material nature. How easily. Just a little tremble of the earth. Yeah? Just like, what was it, about a month ago or something, there was an earthquake in Italy, and all these old buildings came crashing down. Just a little shake. Could you imagine if the earth shook, just like you see sometimes when the dogs, they come out of water and they shake themselves all over, from one end to the other? Just imagine if the earth shook like that. What would happen? Everything would be finished. And it's not to say that the earth can't do that. Or like these tsunamis, a big tsunami comes. And it doesn't take much for the earth to produce things like this, or volcanoes. Just a little flexing of the muscles of the material nature, and everything you have is finished in a moment. So it's not worth making such big, big endeavors, Like they think, like with this economic situation, I was reading something, one of these economic gurus, as they call them, was telling people what to do, what's the safest thing to do during economic difficulty. And he said, cash is king. So just stockpile all your cash. But how quickly does that cash become worthless? How quickly can you lose all that cash? So it's all temporary. It's all very, very fleeting, short-lived. So actually, there's no security in this material world whatsoever. The only security is the lotus feet of Krishna. This is the only thing that's certain. This is the only thing that's sure. So a devotee understands that and utilizes everything they have for the satisfaction of Krishna. Not that we spend all our time simply trying to increase our material facilities so we can enjoy a better standard of life. And also, if we do have material facility, we understand what it is for. We understand that actually all this material facility is simply meant for the pleasure of Krishna. Because it is nothing but his energy, as he describes in the Gita. He says, Aham savasya prabhu matha savam pavatati iti makavijantema buddha parasamandhita. The one who's intelligent understands that I am the source of all spiritual material worlds, and that everything emanates from me. He says, the wise who know this perfectly engage in my devotional service and worship me with all their hearts. So one who is actually wise understands Krishna's position. Therefore, they know what to do. They don't use the material nature simply for their own satisfaction. I'll read the purport. One may argue that a wealthy man may conceal his money so expertly by investing it in banks, stocks and properties and so on, that there is no danger of theft. That may be, but look what's just happened. So many banks have just ceased to exist overnight, just recently. Stocks have gone down. I was talking to someone the other day, and they were telling me how they lost 35% of their net wealth just because of the drop in the stock market. I had the experience, it is from various donations we got last year for the Mayapur Academy. I had $14,000 Australian dollars in donations. And then the time I got the donations, the money was worth 98 cents to an American dollar. No, 98 Australian dollars was worth 98 cents American. And then in the space of 2 weeks, it went down to 68 cents. So, value was lost. But that's just the way of the world. You can't expect that, that you're going to make big money. You can lose things so quickly. Only foolish people actually hide money by burying it in the ground or placing it under a mattress. But despite the despite the fact that the majority of the world's wealth has been accumulated in highly developed capitalistic countries, these countries are being severely challenged by many enemies who threaten at any moment to overrun the capitalists and steal their wealth. Similarly, we find that the children of wealthy people are kidnapped. This is quite common in India. You'll see that many, many wealthy people, they actually have security guards. Because, they, you know, in Bombay you'll see it all the time. You'll see wealthy people doing... I remember a few years ago I was doing Prikram around Govardhan, and there's this wealthy man there, and he had about 15 or 20 men with like these black uniforms and machine guns walking around Govardhan with him, you know. I thought, that's really interesting, that even the security guards get to do Govardhan Prakrama. So they're getting great benefit from it. But, you know, because he was fearful of being kidnapped. And the wealthy people are like that in India. They're fearful of being kidnapped at any moment. And then their parents must pay huge ransoms. Sometimes the parents themselves may also be kidnapped. Furthermore, there are so-called investment counsellors who are expert in stealing the money of rich people. And in the modern age, governments have also become expert in stealing money by taxation. Thus the word artavit indicates one who by hook or by crook is expert in stealing the hard-earned wealth of other people. The bees work frantically to produce honey, but they will not enjoy their honey. As Lord Krishna states, Mrityu Sava Harascham, I will come as death personified and steal everything. Somehow or other, one's hard-earned material opulence will be stolen, and therefore, as mentioned in this verse, one should not work uselessly like the foolish honeybee. Also, we see Kapiladev in the Bhagavatam. There's a nice verse there, which says, Hastani sahastanan apadani chudushpatam palguni tatramahatam jivo jivasya jivanam. That Hastani sahastana, those who have hands, or those who don't have hands, they pray for those with hands. Apadani chudushpatam, those without legs, they pray for the four-legged. The weak, can't remember the next line. The weak are a subsistence for the strong, and the general rule holds true that one living entity is food for another. So we see in this, the food chain is basically what Kapiladev is describing here, is that the weaker living entity prays, the stronger living entity preys upon the weaker living entity. And that's exactly what happens, is a person may accumulate a lot of money. You know, so then he becomes prey for those who are smarter or stronger. And just like, you know, like in, I remember quite a few years ago I was in South Africa, and it's quite a, I don't know if it's still like that, maybe you can educate us, but at that time it was quite a common thing that someone would pull up to the traffic lights, you know, out in the country, you know, not in the sense, but you know, a little bit sort of removed where there weren't so many people. Someone would pull up in the traffic lights in their nice BMW or fancy car or something like that, and just out of nowhere, someone would come running over the hill with a gun, stick it in their face, throw them out of the car, and drive off in the car. They've got a gun, they're stronger. And I remember one time, I mean, South Africa, I don't know if it's still like this, but it was such a wild place. We were down at the beach in Durban in a car, we're just coming back from the Rafi Yatra. And there was, I think, from memory, there was Govinda Maharaj, Indra Maharaj, Sri Pallad, and myself were in the car. And it was a convertible. And just we were sitting there at the lights, there was a traffic, you know, all the traffic were waiting at the lights, and next thing you know, you hear these gunshots, and these guys sort of rolls across the back of the car, and this other guy's chasing him down the road with a gun. You know? So you see again, you know, the weak are being preyed upon by the strong. You know, the guy's got the gun, so he's stronger. I mean, who's going to argue with a gun, except someone with a bigger gun? You know? It's the same rule. It's the law of the jungle. So we see in uncivilized societies it's like that. It's the law of the jungle. The weak person is preyed upon by the stronger person. And that's what's happening in this world. Because they're not following culture. They're not following culture society. Yeah. They think it's culture, but it's actually hog-dog culture. Prabhupada would say polished cat and dog society. They're doing the same things as the cats and dogs, but just in a fancy way. Yeah. So... you know, human life is meant to be governed by culture. It's meant to be governed by rules and regulations. Like we have the Manusamhita. The Manusamhita gives the rules for civilized life. The Vedic culture is about the rules of civilized life. But in this day and age, you know, they're thinking they know better. They have their scientific development. They have all their, you know, different things like that. And they think this is better than Vedic culture. But actually we see the society is becoming more and more and more degraded. Every day you hear, you know, more and more horrible things. And because they have no culture. They've given up culture simply for economic development. And you see, you know, even now we see the government does whatever they can to please the Vaishyas, because the Vaishyas give them money. And that perpetuates their standard of sense gratification, whereas previously the government would act according to what the Brahmanas would say, because the Brahmanas understood what was best for everyone, whereas the Vaishya, he only understands what's good for himself. It's, you know, the lower order, you know, the Kshatriyas and the Brahmanas, the higher orders in society, and the Vaishyas and the Sudras, the lower order. And we'll see eventually we'll get to the point where it's the Sudras giving direction to the government. It's actually starting to happen now, you know, the sports stars and the movie stars and people like that. They're Sudra in nature. But it's not to say that one person's better than another, because all the limbs are required in the body. You know, they're all required. It's just they have their various functions. When the functions get messed up, then things become topsy-turvy, as we see now. Things are very, very topsy-turvy. I just wanted to... I heard a few days ago about a very dear friend of mine who left his body in Vrindavan. I just wanted to say a few things about Dadu. Dadu means old respect. It's like father. Yeah? So his name actually wasn't Dadu. His name was Dhiran Sen. He was an elder Bengali gentleman. Yet he had this service in Vrindavan for many, many years. He used to, maybe 20 years or more, he used to deliver the mail. So he became known as Mail Dadu. Very, very wonderful man. He was like an old world sort of a gentleman. He was probably in his 80s, maybe 90s. I don't think I ever knew how old he was. But he was an older world gentleman from Bengal. He grew up during the time, you know, after the British, you know, not long after the British. And so he, you know, he was cultured, quite a cultured. And he had an amazing sense of humour. And he actually wrote a book of stories. And I remember one of the stories, he didn't write the book. Daivi Shakti Mataji put the book together based on, you know, from stories that he told. And they were really all real funny stories. One of the stories he told was about when Parvati got married. Yeah, to Lord Shiva. So Lord Shiva invited all the various great personalities in the universe. So he also invited Lord Vishnu. So Lord Vishnu thought he would have some fun. And he came to the wedding on Garuda. Yeah? So you know Garuda, right? What's his favourite food? Snakes. And what do we see around Lord Shiva's body? Snakes. Even around, he has his what do you call it, the leopard skin or whatever it is he has around his waist? So instead of a belt, he has a snake holding the belt, holding the leopard cloth up. So as soon as they saw Lord Vishnu on Garuda, all the snakes just disappeared. So of course his belt disappeared also. So his, yeah. You know, so Dadu used to tell many, many wonderful stories like that, you know. And he was very interesting, you know, because he was also very sensitive to the nature of the people he was speaking with, you know. So like, you know, if he was with men only, then he would sort of relate in that way. And if there was a mixed company, he would also be very cautious. You know, he was an old world gentleman. He had class, basically. He was a very classy person. And his sense of humor was amazing. You know, he used to tell me that, he said, I can speak any language. And I said, well, show me. So he'd say, I can speak Russian. So speak to me in Russian. So what he'd do is he'd say all the major cities. I couldn't get it at first what he was saying. But what he'd do is he'd say all the cities in a country really fast, and he'd pronounce them properly, like the way, you know, a Russian person would. So it sounded like he was speaking Russian. And then he'd speak Greek and this language and that language, you know, and it sounded like he was actually speaking. And then after a couple of years, I actually figured out that he was just saying the names of the cities really fast. You know, so he had such an amazing sense of humour. Never left Vrindavan. He had many, many offers to go to the West, and, you know, a wealthy woman from America said, I'll marry you, and things like this, but he never left Vrindavan. And he never wore shoes. He didn't want to disrespect the dust of Braj. Even in the cold winter, he wouldn't wear socks, nothing like that. And you know, he was, I mean, you know, just had such an affection. He and I had such an affectionate relationship. And you know, but he never had any expectation But like oftentimes you find in a place like India, when devotees are poor, that they look towards Western devotees for some material gain. He was never like that. He never expected anything from me. Yet, whenever I gave him things, I remember winter before last, my wife and I bought one of those poly thing jackets. We bought him a jacket, a really warm jacket, because it gets quite cold in Vrindavan. It gets down to around zero. And the buildings are all concrete, so they don't offer a lot of protection. And every time we'd see him and he was wearing the jacket, he would point to the jacket and he would just express his gratitude for the jacket. He was a very, very grateful person, yet not expecting anything. And always appreciative. And it used to, we used to take lunch with him. I used to take lunch with him when I was in Vrindavan every day. And he was quite a character. It's like, we used to take lunch in what was the Life Member Prasad, and he would know the people there very well, so he would like be very commanding, practically run the show there, because he was Bengali and all the people working there were Bengali, but he was older. And you'll see in India with older men, like in their 80s and things like that, older women, the younger people are very respectful, isn't it? You find that in India, they're very respectful of older people, just like we see, the younger men are very respectful of a Mahatma. And that's part of the culture, is they respect all the people. So, they were very respectful of him. Anything they wanted, they'd get for him. So he would take lunch, we would take lunch together, and I'd get my lunch, and he'd get his lunch. And he'd be, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram. And he'd sit there for like 5 minutes and say, Dadu, what are you doing? Let's eat. Because I wouldn't eat until he started eating. He said, I'm trying to catch him. And what do you mean? What are you doing? He said, I'm trying to catch Krishna and Balaram. I can't eat until I catch them. So he'd be sitting there chanting. He was a real devotee of Krishna and Balaram. That's why, because previously he lived at Radhakund. He was initiated by some Babaji at Radhakund. But he left Radhakund because there was too much politics there. They were always fighting. And then he came to Krishna Balaram temple because he had this desire to be a cowherd boy. He wanted to enter into that mood. So that's why he came to Krishna Balaram temple, because Krishna and Balaram were the main deities. He figured, this is the only place, this is the best place. And so he stayed there in Krishna Balaram temple for maybe 25 years, I think he was there. But he's always trying to, taking prasad and things like that, he was always trying to catch Krishna Balaram. Very, very nice person. So, I'm sure he's left his body in Vrindavan. He actually left his body at 4 a.m. in the morning. So I'm sure that he's had an auspicious departure, and that he's gone back to Goloka to be with Krishna and Balaram. I'm sure of that. Yeah, so thank you very much. I just felt the need to express my appreciation of him, because he's a wonderful person and he will be missed. Any questions on the class at all?
Yeah, Sri Nrisimha Prabhu. The concept of the financially strong preying on the weak. What's going on at the moment is there's this world economic crisis. A lot of people are looking at some large banks in Wall Street having precipitated by getting involved these very risky investments called derivatives. So these banks need money. So they've gone to the government and they said, give us money, otherwise we're going to fall and the whole financial system will fall. So the government says, okay, we'll give you money, but here's the idea, give up the greed, okay? And here's how we want you to give up. So the development in the last week is they're trying to pay off their money as soon as possible so they can go back to business as usual, feel free. So they will, I think just in support of your point, they'll do anything to maintain their lifestyle, to maintain their way of doing things.
And that's because there's sudras and vaishyas in charge. We see, it's an example that Prabhupada would quote quite a lot, is in India some time ago, during the time of Indira Gandhi, there was a grain shortage, and it was against the law to hoard grains. Someone was hoarding grains, Indira Gandhi had them executed, to set an example. But the governments these days are weak, they won't do things like that, because they look at, well, it's biting the hand that feeds me. Because they're dependent upon the money from the vaishyas, You know, why are they spending so much money, giving these people so much money? You know, because of their bad management. It's basically, you know, why are these companies in debt is because in trouble is because of greed and bad management. Why are the governments bailing them out? The best thing would be to let them go bust. And then try to set up, you know, because you're not going to reform these people ever. You can't reform people because their whole sort of, they're just perpetuating their situation. That's all they're really trying to do. And that they'll do anything to perpetuate that situation. They'll beg from them. It's easy money. The government's just handing out $1 trillion or something they're giving out, just handing money out like water. And Prabhupada, I was listening to Lesha Prabhupada, they spend money like water in order to gratify their senses. And that's what the government's doing. They're trying to maintain their standard of living. They're not looking, they're not analysing the whole system, saying, look, you know, we've got a serious problem here. What is the cause? What is the root of this problem? And they talk a few fancy words, but they don't actually do anything about it. You know, they need some serious changes, you know, institutional changes, doctrinal changes. They need to actually look at what's going on in this world. But they won't do that. Because it threatens their standards of living, it threatens their sense gratification. Therefore, nothing will change. And because the focus of their lives is sense gratification, it just leads them to further and further entanglement. And as they get deeper and deeper entrenched in the sense gratification, they get more and more reactions, they become more and more sinful, their standards lower. And it's just a whole perpetuating downward cycle, a self-perpetuating downward cycle. So, yeah, it's not. I mean, I would be very surprised if they did anything different. And it's the old saying, it's like, you know, if you want a different outcome, you've got to do it differently. You've got to change what you're doing. But, you know, they're just going to go back to the same thing so they can spend, you know. I mean, you hear stories about, you know, these executives spending money on themselves, like, you know, incredible amounts of money, giving themselves gigantic bonuses which you and I could live on for the rest of our lives quite comfortably. You know, probably everyone in this room could live on some of the, you know, like you know, I heard something about, you know, like $10 or $12 million bonus for one person. I mean, that's just like a huge for one year. That's a huge sum of money. You know, or someone might spend $1 or $2 million renovating their office. I mean, for goodness sakes, I mean, what do you want to spend so much money on an office? Do you need a desk, a computer, a chair? You know? Maybe a paint job every now and then, but it's just excessive. And it's all focused upon themselves. They're all focusing upon, you know, increasing their own standards of enjoyment. And in this situation, it can lead to nothing but suffering. And as we understand from the Gita, passion ends in distress. These are symptoms of the mode of passion, always trying to enjoy the senses. So naturally, it will come to the point of distress. You know, whether it's short-term or long-term, whatever, it's just going to come to distress. And again, it gets to the same thing because they're focused upon themselves. They're not focused upon satisfying the Supreme Personality of God. They're not focused on the welfare of other living entities. They're just focused upon themselves. Therefore, it will lead to their entanglement and lead to suffering. Simple. Simple thing. Mahatma Ji.
And you said, your motivation means distress and pain.
Krishna said, not me.
Now, when we talk about the financial crisis, I was thinking of, what do you think of Obama? Barack Obama, the president of the USA. Because I was reading an article yesterday in Time magazine. Gordon Brown, Prime Minister of the UK, has written such a beautiful comments, very good qualities like Krishna. So, what do you think of Barack Obama? Is he going to make some progress?
He, if I could just say, he smokes and he does, and he's just lifted a ban where federal money is now available for abortion.
Yeah.
So, that's one aspect of his personality. Yeah. And then, there's another aspect of his personality where he does appear that he has, at least is making some effort to have empathy with the plight of struggling people in America and elsewhere. So I guess you could say, on one hand, he's simple, because I'm simple, you know, and on the other hand, he's trying to do the right thing.
Still, because he doesn't have direction of Brahmanas, he doesn't understand what is the greater well-being, or as this para upakar, he doesn't understand what the supreme welfare activity is, which is giving people God consciousness. He doesn't have any vision of that. Therefore, he may do, you know, it's just like sticking a bandage on cancer, like on a cancerous wound. At least it covers it over, and you can't see it, but it's still festering underneath. So because he doesn't really understand clearly what is the root of the problem, and the root of the problem is ahankara, this thinking, I am this body. Because he doesn't understand that, ultimately he won't make any changes, any effective changes. He may change a few little things here and there, and a few people will be a little bit more comfortable, and a few people will be a little bit worse off, and stuff like that. But because he doesn't have any clear understanding of this tattva-vit, this knowledge, you know, this absolute knowledge of the nature of Krishna, or, you know, etc., the position of the jiva, he won't do anything long term. He won't actually change anything. It means that, you know, it needs that devotees, the people who are running the country are either devotees of Krishna, or they're taking direction from devotees of Krishna, meaning Brahmanas. They need to work like that. You know, otherwise it won't really change anything. It'll just be more of the same. Old wine, new bottle. It may look a little bit better, you know, you can go down and get the home brand one, or you can go and get like the big marketing one with the colour packet and all that kind of stuff. It looks better, but it's still soap powder. What's the difference? It won't change that much. Maybe a few little things here and there. Maybe, you know, they'll get more into fuel efficient cars and things like that and whatever. But, you know, people will still suffer because they're functioning on they're carrying out their life on the premise that they're the body. So as long as people are functioning like that, they're destined to suffering because they're in an illusion.
And you said, pardon to be. You have compassion.
Yeah. Vaishnava is actually, you know, compassionate upon the sufferings of all living entities. Mm-hmm. Saying para upakar, means supreme welfare activity, which is to, you know, help people understand their relationship with God. Okay, thank you so much. Grantarashima Bhagavatamiki, Samaveta Bhaktivrindiki, Jai Nitai Gopremanandi.